Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase studio right here on Michigan Avenue, and we're here until 5 a.m. Thursday. It means Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs. Get your requests in now. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Coming up a little bit later on, Sarah Spain is going to join us from ESPNW and ESPN AM. Radio, and she's going to join us to talk about the Hear the Cheers fundraiser and some of the events that are happening associated with that. We talk to her every year about this, and we'll talk sports too. So that's coming up. We are also going to talk about baseball movies, considering today is opening day for the White Sox and at home opener for the White Sox this morning. And you can hear everybody during the day is going to be out there. So that's coming up. So in honor of opening day and opening day of baseball, we're going to talk about baseball movies. And again, tomorrow, joining us live in studio, Rick Geezer is going to be here for a special baseball edition of Sports Songs, all celebrating the great American pastime, which has started. But it is time now for our biweekly visit with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He joins us to talk TV every couple of weeks, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's welcome Dan to the show. Hi, Dan.
How are you doing, Nick?
All right, how are you?
Oh, busy, but doing well.
Good. Okay, let's talk about the season finale of Baskets, shall we?
Season finale of Baskets, and since it hasn't been renewed, it's sort of lingering and hanging out there as uncertain and cliffhangery. Yeah, so let's all cross our fingers that FX listens to this show and renews Baskets.
Yeah, especially the way it ended. I want to know. I want to know what happens.
But I can also make the argument, and this is not spoiling anything for the listeners, that if this is where it ends, I can see how it's a satisfying emotional ending on some level. How about that?
Yeah,
that would be what I would say.
No, I would. I agree with that. And you know, I would like to continue just because it's great. And I thought the episode. I thought the episode was great and very, very funny and yeah. I mean, just all the way around, really, really great episode. It's capping a great season.
It was. I thought they did a very good job with the sort of somewhat predictable. They're in a house cabin up in the woods. Is it going to be the right cabin? Is it going to be the wrong cabin? Farcical twistiness to it, but it also did so very well by the season's different emotional and family arcs.
Yeah.
And we'll just keep saying one more time, Louie Anderson, so very good. And also in this episode, just a reminder of how good Zach Galifianakis is as well. Just important to give him that credit.
Absolutely. No, he was terrific in the episode, and both Chip and Dale are such, they're such great characters. And I was just really, I really liked what they, in this episode, with the arc that Dale had, I thought that was really nice. It was great. He did a great job as well. All season, he's been very strong.
Yeah, but I hope that FX can find reasons to keep the show going. It's not a huge rating success, but of course, I don't think anyone thought it was going to be. But I feel like it's the kind of show that has enough success of different kinds that at the very least, FX will make sure that everyone involved has the opportunity to take it to a resting place if they want to sort of say, this will be our fourth and final season, this will be our fourth and fifth final season, et cetera. I don't think FX is in the business of pulling the plug prematurely on shows, so if there are more stories to be told in the Baskets averse, I assume that we will get to see them.
Yeah, well, it was a great season, once again, and all too short, in my opinion. It was over before it began, as far as I was concerned. But
it really was over very quickly. 10 episodes go by so fast with a half-hour show on Netflix in this way. So definitely, we're going to need something to talk about next spring. So basically, FX needs to help us.
Exactly. Well, listen, let's stay on the FX front. I have to say, I don't know if I've laughed harder all year than at the barbershop episode of Atlanta. I was scream laughing during the... I watched it three times in a row. I'm blanking on the guy who plays Bibby, the barber. I know he's a stand-up comedian. I've never seen him in anything. He was unbelievably funny in that. And nobody does a better slow burn than Paperboy. Nobody. And I just thought it was incredibly funny and beautifully directed by Donald Glover.
It was wonderfully directed. And I think that maybe it's possible that the show is sort of relying perhaps a little too much on a certain joke-telling structures that I feel like there have been maybe three or four episodes this season that have been a similar, I don't want to say Shaggy Dog, Descent into Madness kind of structure.
Yeah.
But I think that there's been a certain familiarity to it. And every time I think, oh, maybe I hope they do something that isn't like this, they do something that's as good as the Barbershop episode. And I'm like, okay, do whatever you want. Yeah. I'm not going to be the one to tell you to do something different. Yes, it was both another one of those episodes where it all comes around to kind of a punchline at the episode, at the end of the episode, that feels just so right. And yet you're laughing at the dozen different extended cringeworthy jokes in the middle, and there it is, an episode of the show without Donald Glover at all, and without Lakeith Stanfield at all, yet works absolutely wonderfully. Who needs them except that we need them?
It was just so funny, and the situation, you know, and it was similar to the, you know, the episode where Ern's trying to spend his money, and it just keeps, you know, it was similar in that kind of tone, as you said. But with every situation that kept building in that thing, I mean, when they hit the car, when he hit the car, and the woman got out screaming, and he just the hit and run. I'm telling you, I was just beside myself laughing during that. I just thought it was unbelievable.
And I also appreciate that it had the callback to the invisible car accident from last season.
Yes.
So, you know, it's all part of a continuity in this strange, strange world in which Atlanta exists. And bless them. I mean, I feel like probably the episode with Van the week before was somewhat to some degree similar in terms of the, okay, we're taking these people, they're going to go wandering, and the situation is going to go increasingly more absurd, except that episode was much more emotionally painful.
Yeah.
And it's just such a great thing that the show can do is there's very little emotional stakes in the Barbershop.
No.
Is Paperboy going to get his haircut?
Right.
Whatever. but the stuff with Ern and Van in the travel episode was, it just twisted the knife, because it started off in a good place and it just went darker.
Yeah, the ping pong game thing was just, you know, and then but then again, of course, they cut away to the guy in the silent guy in the weird mask who was there the whole time during this horrible argument that they're having, a really, really funny point. And then, of course, what Ern says to him in response to the silence is hysterical. And I just thought, you know, as soon as the girl came up and said, oh, you look really good, and tried to wipe the blackface off of Donald Glover, and Glover's reaction to it, he's like, yeah, you know what, where's that mask you were talking about?
No, he is brilliant. And yeah, this season has been so far so good, I guess. Basically, it's apparently there's a episode coming up in a couple weeks that's going to be 41 minutes without commercials. I believe that is the gimmick of that episode. I think episode 6, which is airing, let's see, this week's episode.
Yeah, it's this week, because the last one was episode 5. Yeah, so this one's going to be 41 minutes, no commercials. Do we know what it's going to be about?
The episode is called Teddy Perkins, and I don't believe we've been sent screeners for it yet.
Okay.
And basically whatever, other than Daredevil, not Daredevil, other than, what is it? Why did I lose the word? Anyway, other than Deadpool.
That's Deadpool.
What I'm looking for. Other than Deadpool, FX is going to let Donald Glover do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
So have fun. And no, looking forward to that one.
Yeah,
41 minutes, no commercial interruption.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm in 100%. Whatever they want to do on that show, I'm there, and I'm probably going to love it. So it's just such a great show. It really is such a great show.
Would you like to know the official FX description for the episode?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Because just like the Baskets introductions, which are nonsensical and meaningless, the episode description on this one is, Darius is tripping in this one. Y'all know I would have been left. And that is the description.
There you go. That's
by Donald Glover, directed by Hiro Murai.
All right. I'm in. I don't care. I'm in. That's fantastic.
Exactly.
All right. Well, listen, I'm interested in you know this career path that Al Pacino has taken, where he's just going to play real guys in HBO television movies. This one directed by Barry Levinson, and he's playing Joe Paterno. How is Paterno? Because I think it's this Saturday, right?
It airs. It is this weekend, and I feel like if you were to sort of line up the different HBO biopics, either directed by Barry Levinson or starring Al Pacino or starring Robert De Niro. So you're looking at You Don't Know Jack, Phil Spector, Joe Paterno, Wizard of Lies. I don't know if I'd be able to tell you kind of a hierarchy of them. And I think that's a concern, is that they all have certain samenesses to them, and you come away with similar feelings of kind of fuzzy morality and ambiguous motivation, and there's a certain appeal to it, and yet I can't say I've come away from any of those movies going, wow, that one was spectacular.
Yeah.
Wow, this one was better than the ones before. And I don't know that I've walked away necessarily saying, oh, this is worse. I think maybe Phil Spector was worse than a couple of the other ones, but I don't know. And that was the one that wasn't directed by Barry Levinson. That one was David Mamet.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, they're all very familiar. They're rarely revelatory. And the point is to kind of sit back and watch these overqualified actors do good work for an hour and 40 minutes and leave you uncertain how to feel at the end. And that's basically what it is. And Paterno is similar. It covers the 1 week between when he broke the NCAA Division I coaching record for wins, which was timed at almost the exact same time as the release of grand jury indictments against his former defensive coordinator, Jerry Sandusky.
Right.
And then within 2 weeks, basically Penn State had been turned upside down, and the university's president and athletic director were on the verge of being fired, and the question of what was going to happen to Joe Paterno, and it was all based around what did he know, when did he know it, who did he tell, did he do enough, did he do enough legally, did he do enough morally and ethically, and so a lot of these questions kind of remain outstanding years later, and Joe Paterno passed away very soon after this, and so a lot of the questions are never going to be probably satisfactorily answered. And so there's a lot of doubt, and that's what you come away with after an hour and 40 minutes is watching Al Pacino and being, as always, impressed that he's doing his thing. He's not doing really an exact impression of Joe Paterno. Anyone who knows and remembers Joe Paterno remembers that he had this very distinctive high voice, high nasally voice, and that's not what Al Pacino's doing. Al Pacino's basically just being Al Pacino.
Yeah.
Not yelling very much, so at least it's not that kind of thing. At least it's not Any Given Sunday, which is a lot of yelling. But yeah, you don't necessarily come away at the end knowing anything you didn't know before. You just come away maybe a little bit more uncertain than you were before. Mm. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. It's just not earth-shattering.
Right. Well, that's, you know, that's exactly what I thought of every time that's exactly what I think every time I see a commercial for it. So, Dan, hang on, okay?
For sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. He joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. He's TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E. And take a break for the news and then more TV talk right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor. Or no, we're in the Showcase studio. I'm getting used to it. We're in the Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in. We'll play them later. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. That's also talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected, though, is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Coming up in a little bit, we're going to talk with ESPN's Sarah Spain. We're going to talk sports, and we're also going to talk about the fundraiser Hear the Cheers, which we talk about every year with Sarah. It'll be fun to talk to her. And we're going to talk, since baseball season is off and running and the Sox home opener is today, we are going to talk about baseball movies. And keep in mind that from Steve Cochran on all day, everybody's going to be out at Guaranteed Rate Field for the Sox opener. So make sure you stay tuned for that. Joining me right now is Dan Feinberg. Dan joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. He's from The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And welcome back, Dan.
Thank you much.
Okay, a couple of things we need to talk about concerning Roseanne. I did not watch it. I know that, like, I'm one of the six people that didn't watch it. So I'm not like the biggest fan. I wasn't really the biggest fan. There was no sense of urgency for me to watch it. But two things you wrote about: what's right and wrong from the huge Roseanne return. And then what was it? The other night they took a slam at Black-ish and Off the Boat.
They did. They took a pretty gratuitous and rather poorly written, I would say, elbow in the gut of fellow ABC companies Fresh Off the Boat and Black-ish on this week's episode. And I was left pretty sour by that. It seemed gratuitous. It's not the way that power is supposed to work. It's one thing for shows to be cheeky and to make fun of the network that they're on and to sort of speak truth to power, but there's no such thing as speaking truth to a show that draws 3 million viewers and a 1.0 in the 18 to 49 demographic. Then you're just picking on a couple comedies on the bubble, and that was what it felt to me like Roseanne was doing, especially with Fresh Off the Boat. Black-ish is going to be okay, but yeah. Fresh Off the Boat needs whatever help it can get, and there's really no particular reason for.
And also, I mean, I didn't see it, so I can't speak to the to what was written or how it was written or how it was delivered. But it's also the underlying thing about this, a very white show taking a crack at two shows that are ethnically diverse, seems uncalled for as well.
It was just one of those things where I watched it and I came away unsure where they thought the joke was. So the point is that Dan comes back and he's missed the evening program and the evening programming on ABC, and there's a joke about how he missed the shows with the Asian families and the Black families, and Roseanne laughs and goes, let me summarize it for you, we're all the same. And it's just like, oh, is that what you think the message of these shows are? I mean, for heaven's sakes, Black-ish last night did an episode, the other night did an episode on historically Black colleges and universities and why they're distinctive and important for African-Americans even in 2018. Mm. Yeah. The point of that episode was not, in fact, we're all the same. It's here's something very, very specific and distinctive, and whether you happen to be able to relate to it on ways beyond what the text of the show is, it was a very distinctive episode of TV that literally no other show on TV other than Black-ish was going to do.
Yeah.
And it's so strange because you watch a punchline like that and you think, okay, is the joke that Roseanne the character never watches these shows and therefore doesn't know what they are and therefore makes hackneyed assumptions based on what similar shows might have been in 1995? I didn't know what the joke was. It just felt like a really gratuitous swipe at sort of the idea that ABC's family brand is comedies where it turns out that families are all universal, and ABC's comedy brand is actually, here are as many specific families as we can possibly show with their specific lives.
Yeah.
And if it turns out that certain values within that are universal, great, but these are very specific family shows. And so, I don't know. There's been a lot of just a lot of conversation about Roseanne, and the more conversation there is about it, and the more that Roseanne Barr on Twitter injects herself into these conversations, and the more that our president tweets about how he congratulated Roseanne for her ratings,
it
becomes harder and harder to just view the show as whatever it is. And I gave a fairly positive review to the show as what it is, and I don't know that I necessarily regret that. I just don't know that I can watch what the show is at this point, because it's become basically impossible for me to step away from it.
Well,
and
yeah.
It's not impossible for others.
And that's why, Dan, I haven't bothered. That's exactly why I haven't bothered. I never really loved the original show in the first place. It was never appointment TV for me. So I just don't feel like I'm missing anything. I'm watching, you know, the crap storm around it right now. But that's that. But now, what are the takeaways? Because you wrote about the right and wrong takeaways from the Roseanne return and how big it was.
I sort of I gave some thought to whether the concept of the show as Trump TV was appropriate, and I guess clearly that's part of it. I think it's unavoidable that there is some of that in terms of the audience that's watching it. I think that there's still a lot of nostalgic viewers who aren't Trump supporters, who used to think that Roseanne was a fairly progressive show, who now no longer have a clue how to view it, and
yeah.
No longer have a clue how to view the mixed messages that have been delivered within each of the episodes. There's this one episode after another where you go, oh, this one is about gender acceptance and about accepting people for who they are and not slotting people into categories and letting people be themselves. Oh, that's a good message. And then last night's episode was about the importance of disciplining and spanking your children and other things that other people who watch much more Roseanne than I did back in the day say ran very much counter to what the show's message used to be back in the day. So I don't know. Anyway, so there was all of that. And then I also took sort of the opportunity to muse on, you know, sort of remakes and revivals and reboots that work, and why certain shows that actually had perspectives in the time that they aired can come back if they have something to say about 2018 or 2019 or whenever they're actually going to premiere, and how that is of more value than your Fuller Houses or even your MacGyvers, where the premise is basically, okay, here's a core premise, let's do it with today's technology, let's do it with today's kind of whiz-bang effects and all of that. And so if everything is being rebooted and revived and all of that, certain things feel like they're good bets and other things feel like they're bad bets, and then you never know when a thing that seems like it's going to be a good bet is torpedoed by the creator of the show retweeting memes about Parkland victims and comparing them to Hitler Youth. So yeah. there's just no way of knowing what's going to make a revival or a reboot exciting to watch and entirely unwatchable.
Yeah. I mean, if, you know, in that regard, as far as reboots go, I mean, I think the most surprising and the most successful is One Day at a Time, and what the direction they took there, how they changed it, how it still remained, you know, like a potent Norman Lear show. And what they did with that, I think, is kind of, you know, that's the bar that should be, that people should strive for, is what they did with One Day at a Time.
It is. But even that kind of leaves me a little nervous, because One Day at a Time is a show I love, and yay for Netflix for ordering season 3.
Yes, I remember the last time we talked, they hadn't said whether they were going to renew it or not.
Yeah. Which is great. But I still wonder if there is an audience out there that sees the title, goes, I know what One Day at a Time was, I don't need to watch it anymore, or I know what One Day at a Time was, why are all these people speaking Spanish? That's
yeah.
not what One Day at a Time is. So that's the kind of thing where, because it's a straight-up remake, it's not, you know, it's not really a revival or anything
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
I do wonder what the advantage of having that title is, other than the great Gloria Estefan
version of the song, right?
which is so good.
Yeah.
But I do wonder if there is an audience out there that turned away from it, either because of familiarity or because of the absence of familiarity to the brand that they once knew. And if this was a show with a completely different name and it was simply a fantastic show about a multi-generational Cuban-American family with the wonderful Rita Moreno and with Norman Lear as executive producer, if it might have found a different kind of audience.
Yeah.
Been staying away. I don't have an answer to it. I just wonder this.
No, that's interesting. Yeah, no, that makes sense. By the way, similarly, you had an IndieWire contribution where they asked, what are the best reboots, revivals of a TV show? And you again went a little crazy on this one, Dan.
Well, part of the problem was that I don't know that anybody is defining revival, reboot, and remake in the same ways, person to person.
Yeah.
And this became a thing where basically everyone had to give answers based on however they were defining it. And so basically I went through one after another saying this wasn't a good idea. And finally, I think my consensus answer was that the best reboot or revival was Coach, because NBC ordered it, made a big deal about how they were bringing Coach back. Someone sat down in a room and actually gave consideration to what it would take and said, yeah, this probably wasn't right. This wasn't necessary. We didn't need to do this. And thus, Coach did not come back. And to me, that is the best possible idea, is you take a brand, you say, okay, let's try it. And when it turns out that you don't have the show, you don't foist it on viewers. You simply hide it away somewhere and never sees the light of day.
Yeah, that makes sense. Before we break here, now we all know that Roseanne is doing gangbusters in terms of ratings. How did Will and Grace do?
It's done very well. It hasn't done anywhere near the numbers that Roseanne did.
Yeah.
Roseanne in live plus 3 day viewership did 25 million viewers. That's just
wow,
ridiculous. Yeah, it did 18 million live and then got a tremendous DVR bump. You just don't see that. And the second episode this week, I think, did 15 million viewers live. So the drop was 18 million to 15. But if you told ABC they were going to do 15 million, if you told them they were going to do 12 million, probably if you told them they were going to do 8 or 9 or 10 million, they would have been overjoyed. And so, yeah, huge numbers. Will and Grace has not done that. On the other hand, NBC's comedies, NBC's just been the home of low-rated, adored comedies at this point, basically since must-see TV ended. So it's doing better than things like Superstore and Great News and Carmichael Rest in Peace and Better Than the Good Place. So it's doing well in that respect. They ordered it for a second season before it premiered, and they've already ordered it for a third season now. So Will and Grace will be around for a long time.
Okay. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
For sure.
Got it. Dan Feinberg is with us. We're talking TV, as we do every 2 weeks. TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Let's take a break. When we come back, more TV talk with Dan after this. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. We're here till 5. Right now, though, we're talking with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Let's welcome Dan back to the show. Hey, Dan.
Hello.
All right. You tweeted about Sterling K. Brown, a quick tweet, and I want to talk about that, but I also want to talk about that specific episode of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I watched it on my DVR, and I didn't look at what the title was, and the minute it started, when I saw it, I was like, oh my God, they're going to put Andre Brower in the box. And I got giddy. And it was such a, you know, and then I looked at what the title was and it was called The Box. And I just was so happy with that episode. It was the one off. And, you know, everybody knows that Frank was the king in The Box on Homicide. Nobody was better. And to do an entire episode that was all in the interrogation room and have, like, Andy Sandberg do all the tough stuff and have Andre Brower in there, I loved the episode. And then on top of it, Sterling K. Brown's in it. So it's like, it's fantastic.
It was a great episode. And another one of those episodes where, like the Atlanta episodes, when suddenly Donald Glover is just not there and Lakeith Stanfield's not there, and you just go, wait,
yeah,
the show can survive without them. There are so many great supporting characters on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and this episode pretty much ditched all of them, and it was Andre Brower, Andy Samberg, and Sterling K. Brown in a room, and it was fantastic.
Yeah.
And it was such a pleasure to watch Andre Brower going back and forth between simply being his Homicide character and being his Brooklyn Nine-Nine character, and letting Andy Samberg be as loopy as he was. And Sterling K. Brown is just so good.
He's the best.
He's just so amazing.
Yeah.
And it's going to be fun to see when it gets to be Emmy season where the voters go between this and his SNL guest hosting gig, since they're all guest actor in a comedy possibilities.
Right.
And of course, he'll be nominated and probably win again for This Is Us.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's amazing. That was a great episode. Brooklyn Nine-Nine is another comedy that has not yet been renewed for next year. There are like a half dozen great network and cable comedies that are in limbo at this point.
Well, what are some of the other ones besides what we mentioned already?
Speechless on ABC has not been renewed. Fresh Off the Boat has not yet been renewed. And a lot of these are not necessarily surprising. So the fact that these network shows haven't been renewed is not shocking. They are all, you know, sort of bubbly, and I would guess most of them will probably be back. It's just they'll be renewed in May before upfronts. You go to cable, and Baskets hasn't been renewed. The Detour on TBS, which is not a great show, but a show that makes me laugh with disturbing regularity. it's a show that is lewd and gross and out there and unapologetically whatever it is. And, it makes me laugh. Sometimes it makes me cringe. But yeah, so those are just a few of the shows that are kind of sitting there waiting on renewals, and gotta sit and be patient, I suppose.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, I wish more people watched Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Does anybody watch? How does The Last Man on Earth do? Is that renewed? Is that?
It is also not renewed, and that's another show that. They tripled or quadrupled down on the awkward sex stuff this past week, which has always been a thing that they've done with Tandy and with Carol, and they've always enjoyed their dirty talk, their kink, and this week's episode was taking it about as far as it can go on a broadcast network show.
All right. I appreciate what they do on that show, I got to tell you. So
it's a very good show, and I hope that it will be renewed. The reality is that with Fox, because there's no set timetable for when the deal slash merger with Disney is going through, I don't know if that's going to be good or bad for Fox's shows. Like, if they're basically going to bring everything back because it's kind of programming to spin wheels until whatever happens, and it becomes New Fox or whatever it ends up being called, or if they're going to not want to spend the money and they're just going to spin their wheels with live programming and reality, I don't know. It's going to be a mystery, and it could benefit all these shows, including also L.A. to Vegas, which remains hit and miss, but often hits.
That show makes, I got to tell you, that show makes me laugh, Dan. It does. And I know it's not a great show by any stretch, but man, you know, the people on the show, they really crack me up. And Dylan McDermott is great on it.
And ditto again with the Mick and another show, not renewed, certainly could be back, but all of these shows are pretty low rated. It's amazing how low network comedy ratings are at this point, almost across the board. It's kind of
You know what I'm loving about the Mick, and because Caitlin Olson, please, she's amazing. But what has happened with the Mick is it's turned out to be a show that is showcasing some genuinely hilarious and painful physical comedy. Like, every episode, they're doing, like, really hilarious physical comedy. Why am I blanking on the guy with the mustache, his name? Her boyfriend. When he gets beat up by the girls' soccer team, I don't know that was some of the funniest physical comedy I've seen. And, you know, and then, like, Caitlin Olsen getting shot. And while that was played, I mean, they're doing great physical stuff on that show.
I mean, Chip cut off his fingers and bled everywhere for 10 straight minutes at the end of an episode. Yeah. It was just like, this is Looney Tunes now. And that's what it is.
They're trying to switch out the mattress, all the stuff when he wet the bed, and they're trying to switch out the mattress, the stuff that was happening there off the roof and in the, I mean, just... just ridiculous and funny, I think. Hang on, okay, Dan?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. We're talking TV, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Take a break for the news. When we come back, we'll talk more TV with Dan. Right after this. Hey, welcome back, everyone. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Showcase studio here, and we're here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran live at the White Sox home opener starting at 6 a.m. Sarah Spain is going to join us and talk about the fundraiser, Hear the Cheers, and we'll talk sports with her as well. We're going to talk, since baseball season is just starting and the Sox are having their home opener here on WGN, we're going to talk about baseball movies as well. And we got a Blackhawks Express, a pleasant one. It's always good when they beat St. Louis. I don't care if they are out of the run, out of the race. It's always good when the Hawks beat St. Louis. So right now we're talking with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And this is time for his biweekly visit. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's welcome Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you much.
You know, I have to say, I really enjoy Jesus Christ Superstar. And I haven't really watched a lot of the live musical stuff. But I really enjoyed what they did with it. I happen to really be a fan of that musical. And I thought they did a great job with it. I thought, you know, John Legend was good, not great. But Brandon Victor Dixon was unbelievable as Judas, and I thought a lot of the other performances were great too, and I thought the staging was kind of interesting, and I thought it had a nice rock crazy crowd energy, and I really enjoyed it a lot. So, and I know that you liked it.
I liked it. I really don't like the musical.
Okay.
Honestly, I think the musical is, like a lot of Andrew Lloyd Webber from that period, really really repetitive, really weak in the female characters, et cetera. It's just not my favorite. Like, if you made me choose an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical of that period, I'm going to choose Joseph and the Amazing Dreamcoat any day. And yet I thought the production was terrific. I was not in any way sure that I was going to watch. But I thought maybe I'll watch for 15 minutes, and when I get tired of the songs, I will simply stop, and that will be okay. It will not cause me any pain. But you know, I did not turn away at all, and a large percentage of that, you know, the staging was great, and it was such a kind of disingenuous thing, because they announced it was going to be a live concert event or something as a way of saying, oh, it's not a live musical.
Right.
Different kind of thing.
Right.
And instead it was magnificent top to bottom choreography, production design. The stage itself was amazing. The costumes were tremendous. The use of the audience was mostly very, very effective.
Yeah.
As you say, Brandon Victor Dixon as Judas was tremendous. You know, I now would have loved to see him in Hamilton. Very sad. I thought John Legend was, I would say he was very good.
Yeah.
I had limited expectations, and I thought he sold it. I think probably there are Broadway type singers who, you know, and rock type singers, because since it is a rock opera, for better or for worse, who could have done something different. But I thought he was really good. I thought Sarah Bareilles did the best that anyone could do with Mary Magdalene. And then there were a lot of really great supporting performances. Jin Ha, who was another Hamilton veteran, I thought he was great. Yeah. Ben Daniels, who some people might know from Fox's The Exorcist.
Yeah, that's,
I thought he was really good.
I got to tell you something, Dan. When he showed up, I'm like, that's the dude from The Exorcist. What the hell is going on? I was not aware that he was, I mean, I didn't know really his background except for The Exorcist. And then he started singing, and I went, oh, okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought he was really good. I thought Alice Cooper was fine. You know, the King Herod part is basically exactly the Pharaoh part from Joseph,
right,
in terms of the way it sort of stops the show and becomes a one person showcase for basically one number and then is irrelevant.
Right.
But I thought he did that well, and you know, he dropped the mic. That was
yes,
fun.
He did.
So yeah, no, I enjoyed it, and I was surprised by how much I enjoyed it.
It seemed to me, according to my news feed on a social network, everybody was watching it. I mean, were the numbers big for it?
The numbers were decent. The numbers were not huge. They were certainly better than Peter Pan, not nearly as good as The Sound of Music, not nearly as good as Grease on Fox in terms of numbers, and I think that's probably reflective of, you know, different degrees of popularity between all of those shows. You know, Sound of Music has many generations of adoring fans,
right.
And Grease has several generations of, you know, people who grew up with it in a different kind of way. And Jesus Christ Superstar is definitely popular. I just don't think it's necessarily the same kind of thing. But definitely my Twitter feed was watching it enthusiastically, and the ratings were good, not great, maybe even, you know, possibly very good, depending on how one looks.
I also realize that because I did theater in this city for many years, that I have a lot of people on my feed who are theater people. So that's another reason why there were so many people watching it. So that's why, that's another reason why it went through the roof as far as that was concerned. So let's talk about the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling, which I absolutely loved. I'm a massive fan of Gary Shandling, and I think it's by far the best movie that Judd Apatow's ever made. And I, you know, I'm a fan of some of Apatow's movies, but I think this is the best thing. Clearly the most heartfelt and personal for him. 4.5 hours, and it didn't seem a bit padded or long. And it was, I found it emotionally, you know, really, you know, satisfying and fascinating. And it told me a lot about Gary Shandling that I didn't know. And I also thought it was really great about, like, you know, comedians and how they process things specifically, and how this guy did specifically. I thought it was absolutely great.
I thought it was very good. I personally did not think that it was without padding. I think that there are parts in the second episode that to me felt very padded. There's like a 15-minute uninterrupted segment that's basically the Gary Shandling episode of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, okay, well, I've got the rights to this, might as well stick in 10 minutes of it uninterrupted. And there were parts in the second episode where it felt to me like it was sort of half that Gary Shandling wasn't sure himself what the arc of his life was at that point, and half what Judd Apatow isn't sure how to present an arc of a man who wasn't sure what the arc of his life was at a certain point. And some of the time I found that very satisfying, that uncertainty, that sort of attempt to grapple with, you know, how did this happen? How did this person who did these great TV shows, why did he stop doing TV? You know, he wanted to be an actor. Why was that movie with Annette Bening, directed by Mike Nichols? Why was it the thing that basically killed his film career, et cetera? So I thought there was a lot of trying to get answers to things that were unanswerable, that sometimes Apatow did really well, and sometimes, because there weren't answers, he was sort of flailing, it felt, and sometimes that was intentional and worked for me completely, and other times it felt slightly padded, but it never, I was never bothered by it. I think it's really a great film, and it's the kind of thing that makes you remember that Judd Apatow is, you know, he's a studier of comedy.
Yeah.
It's one of the most core things to his DNA. He got his start pestering people to come be on his high school radio show, you know, begging people to do interviews. And an amazing number of people did interviews with him. And, you know, he's done a book that was comedians relating their experiences with comedy. And you kind of feel like, well, maybe at a certain point he should stop making movies that are hit and miss and just start doing these extended long-form interrogations of the comic process, and those might be fascinating. They probably would not make him as much money as
right.
some of his movies
right.
do, and you know that might be a reason why he wouldn't do it, but I would love to see him do a few more of these things where he, you know, just dug deep on some of these people who he obviously knows and who obviously are willing to be candid and emotional with him in ways that they wouldn't with anyone else. You know, who else is going to make Bob Saget cry?
Right.
Which I thought was incredibly powerful. Who else is going to, I don't know, Jay Leno is such a, he's a tough figure. He does not let anybody past the Jay Leno image and facade. And there were a couple times in this where I felt like he actually was doing a little bit of that, where I kind of felt like I saw a person behind the Jay Leno image. And that was really interesting to me. Yeah. So Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah, it was great, and I just found it really, really fascinating. And I just, I mean, I'm a super fan of Gary Shandling, and I think Larry Sanders is one of the best shows that's ever been on television. And the all the sections that were about the creation of that, and you know the direction that it took when he was battling with his manager, all of that stuff to me was fascinating and great behind the scenes stories. I think it's great. And it's the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling on HBO. So, Dan, always a pleasure.
And there's so much TV, and there's always so much TV.
There is, and we'll talk more in a couple of weeks, and I appreciate it. Thank you, Dan.
Always a pleasure talking to you.
All right, buddy, take care. There you go. Dan Feinberg, everyone, and he'll join us in a couple of weeks. TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And Dan will join us again in a couple of weeks. All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll come back with more right after this on 720 WGN.